Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got Medicaid, Mark Hoffman, Planned Parenthood, much more. And joining me this morning in studio is Tribune education reporter Annie Knox is here. Hi, Annie.
Good morning.
Also with us, Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner joins us. Jennifer, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Government and politics editor Dan Harry joins us once again. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning.
And joining us by phone, religion writer Peggy Fletcher Stack is on the road. Peggy, hello.
Hello.
And you can join us, too, with your questions and comments about the week's news. Send those to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter. Put your comments on the website, sltrib.com, or call us live. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Peggy, we're going to start with you because you need to scoot to go cover the a prominent convention that's in town, the Parliament of World Religions. And it's significant that this is coming to Salt Lake City because when the organization was founded, they didn't actually allow Mormons to attend, right?
Well, Mormons could attend but not speak.
Tell us what's their agenda. What's on the agenda today that you'll be covering?
Well, today there's a big plenary session, women's session. So there'll be lots of prominent women from all over the world, 80 countries, speaking, talking about women's issues in the various faiths they represent. That's one thing I'll be going to.
Okay. Well, we'll be looking for your coverage at sltrib.com later today and over the weekend. One of the major stories that you covered this week was a significant anniversary, 30 years since the Mark Hoffman bombings. And for those in the younger crowd or for newcomers to Utah, who was Mark Hoffman?
Mark Hoffman was a Mormon collector of documents and historic researcher who claimed to have found some very, very significant documents about Mormon history, Mormon origins. And he found these documents, claimed that they changed some of Mormon understanding, sold many of them to the LDS Church. They all turned out to be forgeries, kind of caught up with him after a couple of years, and he ended up killing two people with pipe bombs. He's in jail for life.
And he forged hundreds of documents, not just LDS artifacts, but coins,
right.
Betsy Ross, John Hancock. He even forged a poem by Emily Dickinson. I mean, how did he get started doing these forgeries?
Apparently he was doing this and fascinated with it since he was a teenager, even before he was married. He just became intrigued. I think the Mormon angle, he really wanted to change people's understandings of Mormonism. He wasn't fond of Mormonism, but he also figured he could get away with it, and he did for a long time.
Yeah, he fooled so many experts. It's quite amazing the extent of the deceit. And it all unraveled 30 years ago this week when, as you mentioned, several pipe bombs detonated. One was at the judge building, then one in a quiet neighborhood in Holiday. And then the next day, 30 years ago today, a third pipe bomb went off in his car. And Peggy, you were reporting for Sunstone Magazine at the time. Describe the chaos in this town.
Well, when the first two bombs went off, it wasn't clear who the bomber was. And so there was widespread fear, panic, anxiety, people worried about any packages that might have been left on their doorsteps because that was the way he did it. And then the next day, as you say, 30 years ago today, when he himself a bomb exploded in his car, then people thought, oh no, anyone who has to do with Mormon history is in danger. So there were lots of panicked people. It was a major, major story in Utah.
Dan Harry, I understand you were reporting for UPI at the time, and you have a connection to Mark Hoffman.
Yeah, I was a classmate, a graduate of Olympus High in 1973, and Mark Hoffman was in the same class. I didn't know him well, but, you know, I knew to see him in the hallway in passing. He was, I remember, a member of the track team. And, of course, his Olympus jacket, to green and gray, became a factor in the preliminary hearing later.
That's what he was wearing.
Yeah, that was what he was wearing in the judge building, which was his first bombing downtown. I remember that. I was a very young reporter. One of my first stories, and they sent me down to wait for hours outside the judge building, which was all cordoned off. And, of course, police weren't saying much. And I believe it was the Tribune that broke the story about who the victim was. Matt Christensen was the victim of that first bombing.
Yeah, Steve.
Steve, sorry, yes.
Mm-hmm. As I was talking to some of the old-timers around the newsroom, this was such a pivotal moment for a lot of young reporters. Why should Utahns care about this 30 years later? Peggy, I mean, what's the significance for Mormons, for the rare document market, for the state of Utah?
I think the major legacy of Mark Hoffman is a lot more skepticism about documents and their authenticity. It shut down, really, the document market for some years. It's picked up again a little bit, but anybody who claims that a document is going to significantly shift historic understanding, that document will be scrutinized from every possible angle. So it affected how see their history. Mormon history became, since at the time Mark Hoffman preyed on Mormon anxiety about its history a little bit and its secrecy, and now the LDS Church has become much more transparent, much more open, putting many more documents online. And I think he took away some trust, I would have to say.
Dan, anything to add?
I think Peggy got it right. That was the major change that came about because of that. Yeah, I'd say she got it.
Mm-hmm. Peggy, you've got an exclusive interview with Hoffman's ex-wife, Dory Olds. And Hoffman's deception was quite devastating to her, not only emotionally, but financially, socially. Can you give us a quick preview of your piece?
Yeah, I spent a couple of hours with Dory Olds. She divorced Hoffman in 19. He went to prison in January in 1987. She divorced him in 1988, but she says she was a typical Mormon wife, very trusting, very believing, never really asked questions about his business dealings, and was equally stunned as everyone else that this had happened. It took her, even after he pled guilty to the murders, she believed he was a liar and a forger, but it was very hard for her to believe that he was actually a murderer. It took a year or so. After that, she had to support her four kids. She had no college degree. She had not a lot of support, and a lot of people felt like she should have known, and they kind of shunned her. She spent 30 years sort of putting her life back together, but it's been a very, very painful 3 decades.
Mm. Fascinating, terrifying piece of Utah history. Peggy Fletcher Stack, thank you so much for your time today, and we'll let you go back to your reporting duties.
Thank you.
Again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. If you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Before we head to a break, Jennifer Dobner, there was a scare at the state capitol yesterday. The building was evacuated. What happened?
Well, about just before 3:30 yesterday afternoon, a gentleman, well-dressed gentleman in a suit and tie, walked into the Capitol Rotunda from the front doors of the Capitol building carrying a package, about a 5-foot-long package, and placed it in the center of the rotunda, dropped to his knee as if in prayer, and then got up and left. It turns out that was a semi-automatic rifle in the package, which had something written on it and a wreath on top. And, of course, the Capitol is being monitored on video surveillance at all times, and so the UHP troopers were, tried to get on it right away, but they missed him. And they cleared the Capitol, and it was on lockdown really overnight while they sorted out what this actually was. It was called in as a bomb threat, and nobody knew until about 6 p.m. that what was inside this package was actually a long gun that was not loaded. They released some video or some still pictures from the video surveillance.
You can see those at sltrib.com.
You can. And it's actually kind of chilling.
It is.
This guy holding this long box. Apparently after those were released last night, he contacted UHP, and he's been interviewed and released. He's apparently indicated to them that it was a protest against some sort of gun violence. We still don't know what was written on the package. And it's unclear at this time whether or not he might be subject to some sort of prosecution.
So he has not been released, or not arrested. He's not been charged with anything.
Right.
Did UHP say anything about this man, his identity, or anything, demographic profile?
Well, all we know is that he's possibly middle-aged based on what they could see on the video, and I don't know if they've changed that characterization as of this morning. Mm-hmm. And that he's from Cache County. That's really all we know at this time. And I think the contents of whatever it is that was written on the package might be kind of revealing. We don't know if he has some particular issue with gun violence or some personal, you know, experience that has been traumatizing for him that may have motivated this. But it was a very unusual situation. We have a lot of suspicious package bomb threat situations every week. It seems like there's one, and they generally turn out to be nothing. Finding a rifle is really kind of chilling and unusual. So,
what does this say about the security protocols at the Capitol?
Well, I mean, I would say that they worked the way they were supposed to yesterday. According to Keith Squires, the Commissioner of Public Safety, once they saw him move towards the center of the rotunda, there was a trooper there within about 40 seconds. And he had already exited, but they immediately started the procedures to lock down the facility, to evacuate. And Squires talked about this last night, that it's a balance between keeping the people's house, as he called it, open for anybody. I mean, there's always a lot of people in the Capitol, tourists and visitors every day, aside from the people who work in that building. But they still have to be prepared for a threat. He seemed to indicate that things worked the way they were supposed to, even if they didn't catch him right away, because there were no injuries, nobody was hurt, and there was somebody pretty much in that spot in less than a minute.
I've been to a lot of state houses, though, Dan, and you have to go through metal detectors and, you know, your bags are searched. Is it too lax?
Well, they had that debate here. I actually covered the Capitol preservation hearings where they were considering full-time metal detectors at the doors. And in this state, which has a very strong pro-gun culture, that was not going to fly. And so what they did purchase some portable magnetometers that can be wheeled in and wheeled out for certain events. So like during the Olympics, yes, we had a lot of dignitaries, had the president come and visit. We had Secretary of State here and many others, foreign dignitaries. So they wheeled those magnetometers in, but as soon as the Olympics were done, they wheeled them out. Mm. And I haven't seen them back since, although I think they are there for some certain special events. But I got to tell you, having, you know, spent many years covering the legislature in the state capitol, there's a lot of guns up there every day.
Right.
There's a lot of concealed carry permit holders up there, and they're packing. And so, you know, that capitol sees a lot of guns.
Yeah. Well, and this gun was not loaded, and there's no indication that there was any ammunition in the package, although UHP did not specifically answer that question last night when asked by me if there was, you know, they couldn't or they wouldn't answer. I'm not sure which is the correct characterization. But and this person did not take action in terms of attempting to hurt someone or fire upon someone. So I don't know. It is an interesting, you know, question. What's the right balance between preserving openness in a public space like that and the public safety concern?
So it took 40 seconds for a security guard to get to the middle of the rotunda.
Yeah. So UHP is the provides security on the Capitol Complex campus there. So I don't know where they were you know, in the area. There's not like an officer at every door. So I'm not sure where they were in relationship to where he was. Mm. But they are monitoring that area live and other places in real time on video. So somebody saw him. You know, I would assume it would take a minute to figure out what the heck was going on.
Sure.
And then the suspicious behavior at the time he went down on his knee and put this thing down and then got up and walked away. They moved in as quickly as they could. But he still got out the front door and into a car before anybody got to him.
So many questions, but thanks for filling us in on what we know so far.
Sure.
I assume that you'll continue to cover this. Jennifer Dobner with the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state of Utah, on Utah Public Radio. You can join us, too. The number 801-355-TALK, or send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and joining me today in studio, government and politics editor Dan Harry, justice reporter Jennifer Dobner, and health and education reporter Annie Knox. And you can join us to 801-355-8255, or you can put comments at sltrib.com. Dan, another big headline this week. House GOP members voted on the latest Medicaid expansion plan, the fourth such plan, and it was a big loser. Only seven people in the GOP caucus supported Utah Access Plus. Similar lack of support in the Senate. Dan, how did this fall apart?
Well, I don't know that it was ever together. It's kind of strange that the governor and legislative leaders spent months putting this latest plan together, and they go into a closed-door caucus in the House Republican caucus, and they can get only seven votes when the speaker and the majority leader were both participants in putting this together. It makes you scratch your head, is what's going on. Leaders of the legislature are generally very good at counting noses. And clearly that didn't happen here. So it makes you wonder what is really going on.
Mm. The other question that makes you wonder is, where's the discussion going to go from here? I mean, the governor issued a statement supporting his original Healthy mm-hmm. Utah plan. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to make a comeback?
Well, and then in an interview, he said, and our story in today's paper says, you know, basically he's giving up the leadership on this and saying, all right, I'm throwing up my hands, you come up with a plan. And if you look at the history of this legislature, if they come up with a plan, it's not going to be a very extensive expansion of Medicaid. It's going to be a pretty bare bones program.
So, I think in Robert's story this morning, the chatter is the third plan. Plan number three, Utah Cares, could be the one. How would that work?
Well, as I understand it, and my understanding of that is not terrific, but my understanding is that it would increase the number of folks, very low-income folks, on Medicaid. But it also would send several thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, onto the primary care network that exists now. And that comes under great criticism. It came under great criticism when the House was pushing this forward last session about what it doesn't cover. For instance, it covers primary care. So let's say you go in to your doctor and you can get diagnosed with colon cancer, but you can't really do anything about it because it doesn't cover specialists. And so, you know, that really raises a question, is that insurance coverage or not? It's a very minimal type of coverage. It also has limits on the number of prescriptions you can get each year. I think it's limited to five. So, you know, this would be a very patchwork kind of coverage for low-income folks.
And the other thing that we know for sure that came out this week, lawmakers are not going to take up this coverage gap question until the general session in January.
Right.
How are advocates for the poor, for health care, all that community, how are they reacting to the news?
Well, you know, they brought up some folks the other day during the closed-door caucus because, you know, the thing is the public really hasn't heard any of this deliberation. It's all done behind closed doors. And I'll bet there was some pretty good discussion. But We don't know what it was. And so, you know, they are very frustrated. They're out in the hallway, and they've got some folks that, you know, would be covered if we had Healthy Utah or some other version of that. And they're expressing their frustration about just watching and waiting for now. Well, we're into our third year, I think, of nothing being done by the state of Utah. So I think they're just beyond frustrated.
It's interesting to see the governor's position on this change. I will continue to follow it closely. Jennifer?
Oh, I was just going to ask, you know, 3 years this has gone on, how millions of Utah tax dollars lost, how long can it go on, or can it? They just at some point say we're not doing anything, and
they could say we're
done.
Not doing anything. Yeah, they could say that. They haven't said that yet. They keep saying that, you know, they'll come up with something. The governor's motto through all of this has been, "Doing nothing is not an option," but it sure looks like that is still an option.
But they've invested, I mean, I covered some of those.
$450 million in federal funds. If they had passed this latest version of the plan, that would have brought $450 million in federal dollars, which really is dollars that Utah's taxpayers are already paying. They're just not getting it back.
Okay, I guess this answered our caller who did not stay on the line, John from Salt Lake City, asking, can the governor still take the full Medicaid expansion? Any chance he might do that?
Well, I don't think the governor has shown any inclination to do that, no.
Well, and didn't the legislature pass a bill that said he can't do anything without our approval? So his hands are a little bit tied.
Well, I don't know about that. I think there's some legality questions about that, so.
John, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is that number if you want to join us. Another big story this week. Yesterday, Planned Parenthood went to court, speaking of the governor, presenting arguments in a case against Governor Gary Herbert. And Annie, you were there. What's at the heart of this case?
Planned Parenthood sued the governor September 28th, I think it was, after about 2 weeks after he ordered federal funds to stop flowing through Utah through to the organization. So that's about a little over $270,000. It's a small slice of Planned Parenthood of Utah's overall budget. They get about $8 million, but they said this is still a sizable chunk for us. It goes to STD testing and monitoring, after-school sex ed programs. So then Planned Parenthood sued the governor saying, you have violated our constitutional rights, 14th Amendment, First Amendment, free speech. And now Planned Parenthood is saying, we want to make sure that this funding can at least continue while the court case is pending. So that's what a judge is weighing right now. He heard arguments yesterday. It was U.S. Federal District Judge Clark Wadups. And he said, I'm going to take some time to weigh this decision. And in the meantime, the funding will continue.
Hmm. Interestingly, Planned Parenthood entered into evidence some emails from state health department officials. What do those emails say, Annie?
Those emails come from a number of employees who were asked to provide some talking points before the governor issued that directive. And basically, they said there are going to be a few thousand people who will have to pay for STD testing or won't be able to get it. Likewise, with treatment, if the federal money is cut off. You know, the officials said there are some ways we could divert the money to other organizations, to other providers, but any way you do it, some people are going to be missing out.
Dan, I mean, a big part of this is about a contract agreement. A big part of this is political.
Huge part. And I think that's what the court case is trying to get at is, you know, what really prompted the governor to do this, and what he has said publicly is that he was outraged by these videos that were released and the idea that they were trying to sell fetal tissue and profit from that. And, you know, he has acknowledged himself, Utah Planned Parenthood had nothing to do with those videos. Even if you accept their validity, which a lot of people don't, they say they're heavily edited. And it came from an organization with an agenda. But Planned Parenthood of Utah had zero to do with those videos. And so I think at the crux of the matter is here, is he punishing an organization that the state has a contract with for something that it had nothing to do with? Mm. And, you know, this all happened on the eve of the state Republican convention, where the governor had found out, I think, right about that time, that the fellow challenging him had bought time to speak for 8 minutes on the stage and was going to launch his campaign against the governor at that point from the right. So, yeah, you know, you can't look at this whole situation and see this is all politics.
Annie, what did state attorneys say? How did they defend the governor's action?
They said, you know, if there is some reason to believe that Planned Parenthood of Utah's associates in this case, the national organization, were somehow engaging in something illegal, then the state has the right to end the contract, believing that, you know, they could be working together in some way.
I think they compared it to cutting loose an employee, mm-hmm. somebody who wasn't doing what they were supposed to be doing.
And there have been cases related to employees in the past, but apparently very few, if at all, any, that have dealt with contractors.
You mentioned that the contract with Planned Parenthood is for sexually transmitted disease education, prevention. Who was providing those services while the court figures all this out?
Well, those are going to be continuing. So Planned Parenthood is still going to be doing a few of those and working with other organizations and working with the state, especially to track and monitor the STDs.
And did Judge Wattups indicate when a decision might come down?
No, I think he said something like in the near future. So
that's
we're not exactly
big.
Sure when that's going to be, but just waiting for that while, of course, the larger case pens.
Okay. Annie Knox, thanks so much for that report. Another big story this week, Utah Congressman Chris Stewart let people know how he really feels about former government contractor Edward Snowden. And joining me on the line is Justice reporter Nate Carlisle, who covered this story. Nate, good morning. And what did the congressman say about Edward Snowden?
Good morning, Jennifer. The congressman called Snowden a traitor. He acknowledged that some of the documents Snowden released addressed real privacy concerns, but pointed out that Snowden took a lot more documents than that. And for that reason, Chris Stewart considers him a traitor and thinks that Snowden ought to come home and face the music.
Yeah, pretty strong comments that came during a national security conference being held at the University of Utah. What was the reaction in the room, Nate?
I was pretty stoic. I mean, this conference didn't exactly it didn't exactly draw some of the more liberal elements in American politics. It was a pretty gung-ho military audience, and so there was no arguments with Stewart's position.
Snowden is going to be speaking via satellite to a Park City audience in December. I guess we can assume that the congressman is going to skip that event, huh?
He made no mention of purchasing tickets.
Okay. Another couple stories that you've been following out of Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City, Arizona, affectionately known as Short Creek. First, there was a story, I can't remember if it was today or yesterday, it all blurs together. Town marshals are being scrutinized after two men were arrested at a site owned by the FLDS Church. First, tell us about these arrests.
Well, the church doesn't own the zoo. The United Effort Plan, which is the land trust that the state of Utah controls,
my bad,
owns the zoo.
Thanks for the correction.
And, well, it's okay. I mean, your question kind of gets on the conflict there, that the United Effort Plan was once basically run by the church, and church members still feel as though they have a valid claim to all that property. And so what happened this week was two men obtained a lease to start using the zoo for raising crops or livestock, and they got a lease from the United Effort Plan. They show up at the zoo, and according to people who were there, they served eviction notices to anybody that was on the property, but one man claimed then that he resided there in a little, it's either a shed or a caretaker's house, depending on whose version you believe, and at that point, the Hilldale marshals show up, Hilldale, Colorado City Marshals show up, and start telling the leaseholders that this is a residential property, someone has a claim to it, you can't throw them off, and accuse the leaseholders of trespassing. And there was a big back and forth, sheriff's deputies from the county and on the Utah side and on the Arizona side showed up, and there was a conflict between those deputies and the marshals, but the marshals decided they were going to arrest the man if they didn't leave. They refused to leave and asked to be arrested, and that's precisely what happened.
This is just the latest episode in a long string of questioning about where the loyalty lies for these marshals, with the U.S. government or with the FLDS church leadership, right?
That's accurate. There is a civil rights lawsuit pending right now that's going to go to trial in Phoenix, where the U.S. Justice Department is suing the towns over just the kind of allegations you mentioned. The timing here was probably not good for Hilldale and Colorado City, though they claim that they do have a legitimate case against these two men about the trespassing charge. The men have been charged with misdemeanor trespassing in the municipal court on the Arizona side, and those charges are pending.
And as you point out, one of the men appears in a controversial documentary, Prophets Pray, right?
Well, it's probably only controversial if you're a big supporter of Warren Jeffs. Andrew Chatwin, one of the men arrested, is in Prophets Pray. He's worked with other investigators over the years to document what goes on in Hilldale and Colorado City. And so anyone who is loyal to Warren Jeffs was probably not a big fan of Andrew Chatwin in the first place. And that would probably come up as an issue if either the trespassing case goes to trial or if this matter is brought up in the civil lawsuit in January. Mm.
Another interesting story that you reported this week, the birth rate in these two towns known as Short Creek has dramatically dropped. What's going on?
Yeah, there practically isn't a birth rate anymore. So once upon a time, there were about 400 babies a year or more being born in Hilldale and Colorado City, which would put it way above the birth rates in the two states. But in the last 3 years, there have been just a handful of births on the Hilldale side. There was only 6 births in all of 2013. There were a few more on the Colorado City side, but Colorado City also has a much higher population of non-FLDS. So it looks like the Warren Jeffs banning of marriages and banning of sexual relations between spouses has just almost eliminated births in the two towns.
It's such a puzzle to wrap my head around this kind of population control. Does it mean have you had a chance to look at the birth rates in other FLDS enclaves? I mean, is it the same kind of end to their population?
There are no FLDS enclaves like Short Creek. I mean, certainly the FLDS do live in other communities across the West, but what was unique about Hilldale and Colorado City was that they had their own clinics that were pretty much run by the FLDS, and so the health departments in the two states were able to get numbers from those clinics. Whereas, let's say, at the compound in Pringle, South Dakota, it would be tough to separate out the FLDS population from the general population. So your short answer to your question is no, I haven't looked at birth rates in other FLDS enclaves, but I honestly don't know what conclusions I'd be able to draw from that if I were to look at it.
Have you drawn any conclusions about what this could mean for the future of Short Creek and the FLDS community there?
Well, I mean, it doesn't look good, does it? When you've got entire years worth of children that aren't being born. I asked the school district if they were worried about this, and it's the Washington County School District. It's a public secular school district, and they claim no, that you know, we keep getting new students at that school all the time because kids keep coming back from, you know, wherever their parents had them in Texas or South Dakota or what have you. That answer didn't quite get into the issue of you know, children that should have been born in 2011, 12, and 13, but at least for the moment, the school district doesn't seem worried.
Certainly an area that keeps you busy. Nate Carlisle, thank you so much for joining us from the Tribune Newsroom this morning.
Thank you, Jennifer.
We're talking about the week's top stories. Again, you are invited to chime in, 801-355-TALK. Put your comments on the website, sltrib.com, or you can tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk. We'll be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City throughout the state of Utah on Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. We're talking about the week's headlines. And if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Jennifer Dobner cannot wait to get started on this story.
I wouldn't say that.
Salt Lake City settled a sexual harassment lawsuit this week with three female officers. And Jennifer, give us the detail.
Yeah, these three women sued over sexual harassment. They claimed that over a period of 2 years, an assistant chief had harassed them and ruined their reputations, and that this city basically had done nothing for months and months, and so they filed the suit, and this week they settled. Essentially, each woman is going to get a cash compensation of about $85,000 a piece, but I think the more important part of this is that the department and the city have agreed to policy changes in the way they approach how sexual harassment claims are, you know, processed and handled by the department. There's going to be some training both by HR people and by outside experts, and they're also going to do increase some efforts to recruit more female officers. I think the numbers have declined significantly in the last couple of years because the climate was not friendly to women.
This harassment issue became not just a departmental issue, but a campaign issue during the Salt Lake City mayor's race. What role did Mayor Ralph Becker have in bringing this settlement about?
Well, if you talk to Ed Brass, the attorney for the three women, it's a significant role. And that has to do with the fact that he had essentially asked former police chief Chris Burbank either to, you know, resign or fix this, and Becker has said that he knew about this a year, you know, like more than a year ago, and that Burbank's inaction basically forced a notice of claim telling the city they were going to be sued, and then resulted in a sort of a standoff between Burbank and Becker. Becker's taken some hits for pushing out Burbank. Burbank was a widely respected police chief who had done quite a bit to sort of make inroads into some of the marginalized communities in Salt Lake, and people really liked him. But Becker felt he'd been not handled this thing effectively. Ed Brass, the attorney for the women, says had they not gotten a new police chief, there would be no settlement. That the top-down change came with an attitude shift in which these claims were considered valid for the first time.
And the attorney for the women also thinks that these changes are significant enough to change the culture of the department?
I think that's the hope. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the sort of the motivation really behind the lawsuit is really not money. It's about the treatment of female officers. It's about being taken seriously when somebody exercises, you know, undue control over the way you can perform your job. As Ed says, you know, they just want to be cops and be judged on their merits. They don't want gender to be an issue in their professional relationships.
Dan Harry, this has been a very neck-and-neck contentious mayoral race. Did Ralph Becker need this to go away before Election Day? And is it going to make a difference?
The big turning point in the campaign was when Ralph basically forced Chris Burbank out. that lost a lot of his supporters right then. A lot of people started taking a second look at the race, and I think that remains the biggest factor in this campaign. The settlement of it, I think, is a good thing for everybody involved, including the politicians. But it does raise again the questions of what happened for a year after the mayor knew about these substantiated claims of sexual harassment. And he basically had ordered the police chief to demote the deputy chief responsible, Rick Finley. But Burbank didn't do that. Instead, he put him on administrative leave and then allowed him to retire. Burbank made the argument that demoting him would have done nothing different. He would have actually been able to come back to the job, and he still would have been able to retire with full benefits. But the question remains, why did it take a year for the top administrators to do anything about this?
Election day, just a couple of weeks away at this point.
Actually, people are voting right now.
I guess that's right. The mail-in ballots are out.
We had a story today that said almost 7% of the ballots after 1 week are already back. So that's one out of every 15 registered voters have already voted. And, those numbers are just going to keep piling up over the next few weeks.
Mm. Another story that we've been covering is the saga of San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman. Earlier this year, he was convicted for orchestrating an illegal ATV ride on protected lands. This week, he got another note of distinction. And Dan, tell us what happened.
Yeah, it was he was elected as the Utah's County Commissioner of the Year by the Utah Association of Counties. And I think that some of his peers, lauded him for standing up to the big bad federal government, was the attitude. But if you look at it from another perspective, and I noticed several of our letters to the editor on this yesterday, were that these are elected officials who are in the business of upholding the rule of law. And you often hear that, particularly among conservatives, but also others, that, their job is to, part of their job is to say, look, we have these rules, we have these laws in place. You can agree with them or disagree with them. You obey them. If you want to change them, get involved in politics, go to the ballot box, go to the legislature. But that didn't happen here. And so it does raise the question of what kind of example is this when our elected leaders are sort of elevating somebody who is convicted of a federal crime.
And on Lyman's part, his statement seems to indicate that he is not only flattered, but feels like the recognition vindicates his position.
Yeah, he sees a vindication in a lot of areas in this. There was a time when T-shirts were printed up comparing him to Gandhi and Rosa Parks. And, he said, I didn't do that. But, I think that kind of he sort of likes that sort of attention. And I noticed, the local newspaper down there in San Juan County had a story about this County Commissioner of the Year. They didn't mention his conviction. It's kind of odd.
We'll continue to follow the story as his sentencing is still coming down the pike. We need to get to our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. But before we do, can you just give us a quick little summary of what's going on with UTA, Utah Transit Authority?
UTA is an organization that is in the midst of showing that it knows how to reform itself. And the latest one is that their top executives all signed a letter and said, please don't give us bonuses this coming year. We want that money that would have gone to us to be used for public services. So that's another sign that they can be responsible. And, of course, we have an election coming up here. It's underway right now on Prop 1. Which, if passed, would significantly increase revenues to UTA.
Okay. Another election-related story to follow right here at sltrib.com. Underplayed story of the week, the story that's sort of been under the radar, but that could certainly blow up at any point. And Annie Knox, do you want to kick it off?
We had a photographer who found...
That was going to be mine. I just want to say, I love that story.
We can both talk about it.
Okay.
He found the remnants of, I guess, a ski crash of a guy who was coming down Big Cottonwood Canyon, I think 27 years ago, mm-hmm. And ended up finding the Highland High School ID and a bunch of other artifacts from a guy who now lives in Colorado, was able to connect with him on Facebook.
Because he went to high school with our photographer's wife. And I just think it's a really sweet, beautiful, happy story, circle of life kind of thing, which sometimes we don't get enough of. So it was going to be I don't know if it's been underplayed, but people should take note of it. It would make them feel good.
Yeah, check it out, sltrib.com.
Hey, the news doesn't often make people feel good. Come on, let's be honest.
Dan Harry, what's
your
pick?
I am going to continue that feel good.
Oh, good.
fuzzy feeling. That we had a story today about how the state says your wait for a driver's license now averages only 9 minutes.
Awesome.
Now, I find that hard to believe, but given my past experience, but I'm hoping this is true, and I'm waiting to test that.
So I actually need a new driver's license,
okay,
and
well,
I'm going to go on Monday because I work a night shift, so I will time it.
If it's more than 9 minutes, come and tell
me. I will time it, and we will do a front page expose of, you know, another falsehood perpetrated by some government agency.
I think it's the average is 9 minutes, so
yeah.
You could go
okay,
over
what's
a little
my
over
under? We have to figure
we'll
this out.
We'll find out.
Okay.
You'll have to figure that out. My underplayed story of the week is actually education related, since UEA is underway. My kids are out of school, so that's on the brain. This week, the state school board was considering the upgrading of science standards, and apparently in the latest draft is, in middle school, you cannot talk about climate change until the eighth grade.
Because?
I don't know. I'm still trying to work out the details on that. Sixth grade students can learn about the greenhouse effect, but climate change, I think as a term, you will not hear until eighth grade. Food for thought out there. Talk to your state school board leaders if you have questions. I think that's a story that we're going to hear more about. Jennifer Dobner, Annie Knox, Dan Harry of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby is marking his 40th wedding anniversary.
I can't believe it's 40 years. On the other hand, if you look back at the rough times that we had in the past, it is, you know, it does seem like 40 years, but there's a sense of accomplishment there that I didn't realize that I would have when I got this far. I have a picture at home. We'd been married a year when I became a police officer, and a couple years later, we took a picture of the crew that I was working with. There are five other police officers in that group, and not counting my wife and I, and we're the only ones still married.
Really?
Yeah, all of our wives, and we had a party, and so.
You made it.
Yeah, go from one bad, you know, profession that's hard on marriages to another, you know, police work and journalism, and I still managed to pull it off.
Well, she's put up with a lot. You've worked it out. This was a column that you wrote.
Like 5 years ago, 2010.
Yeah, it was a bit ago, about your time as newlyweds. And there is some negotiation that
oh,
is
yeah,
required.
You better be willing to, you better be willing to negotiate. Both at the front end when you're adjusting to each other and on the back end when you've changed. You know, do I still love this person that I married?
Mm.
You know, despite all the changes I've been through. So, yeah. But we had this argument over dishes, and we hadn't been married very long. I'd say it was less than a month. So I wrote this column about it, and I wrote, it was 1975 when we were newlywed poor. We lived in a small basement apartment. The front room, kitchen, and dining area were all crammed into a space the size of our current laundry room. Clutter made it even smaller. Our disagreement wasn't over whether the dishes needed to be washed or even who should wash them. It was over when they should be washed. My wife, a responsible and caring woman even then, believed the dinner dishes should be done within a couple of hours of eating. At the very least, they should be washed, dried, and put away before retiring for the night. I held out for any time within a calendar year. Clean dishes were not high on my list of priorities. Dishes ranked way below several hours spent hand-loading rifle ammunition in front of the TV while thinking up ways to drive the landlord's dog Heber insane. So you can agree that something needs to be done, but you're not going to agree on where it fits in the list of priorities. And eventually, like most things in our marriage, I came around to her point of view.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can hear read a lot more Kirby at sltrib.com. And happy 40th, Robert. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis and Roger McDonough at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, Emily Means from the Salt Lake Tribune. And just another reminder, October 28th, 7 p.m. here at the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City, we will be hosting a debate between Salt Lake City mayoral candidates Ralph Becker and Jackie Biskupski. You can put your questions to the candidates by sending an email to me, JNPEARCE at sltrib.com. You can also tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk. We'll be taking those right up until noon on October 28th. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next week.